Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
Two more great interviews today.
Indeed. We've got Kevin Collard. He's a nurseryman from Litchfield, Kentucky.
An old friend of mine, I have to admit this. He's got Litchfield is about an hour's drive south of here, maybe 60, 70 miles. Very interesting nursery in the town of Litchfield, like 6,000 people. And it's one of those, if you want to take a day trip and go somewhere and see some different stuff, Pine View is a place to go. It's a neat place, and he's a boxwood nut. He's a normal guy, but he likes boxwoods. I don't know what's wrong with him.
Plant people are always like nuts about something.
But we'll give Kevin
kingdom.
A shot to explain how in the world a perfectly normal plant guy can like many boxwoods, but he just has all kinds of them.
Yeah, and boxwood are great plants.
They
really
are.
And they're not as boring as you think they
are.
No,
they're multitaskers.
They are,
functional,
indeed.
And can be pretty tough.
They can be pretty tough. We're also going to talk about worms.
All right.
Worms and soil ecology. It's huge in terms of what worms do to keep the soil healthy. Yeah. And the soil, of course, is the link that our plants have in terms of life and being healthy as well.
Absolutely true.
So Dr. Clive Edwards from Ohio State University is going to join us. Ohio State University is, I think, the virtual center of the world.
It is the worm world
when it comes to soil ecology and earthworm research. So it should be pretty good information. You will likely leave the radio with profound appreciation for the earthworm.
Adopt a pet worm for...
Yeah.
They're out of sight, out of mind.
Yeah.
You don't think about them, but they're...
And they've been abused for so long.
But I love it when you dig soil and there they are.
Oh, so do I.
You're doing something right.
And like when they're really big.
Yeah, right.
It's like, wow, it's amazing.
And you go fishing with them.
So maybe it's a really old earthworm, but we'll find out because I'm sure Dr. Edwards will have the information. So stay with us. That's coming up today on Homegrown. All right, Bob, what's going on in your garden these days?
Well, it's more of a pet peeve. I was in a nursery the other day, a box store really, which I like to visit box stores just to see the plants. And there was a nursery guy in there, a landscaper, one of those guys with a pickup truck and a shovel, I think is what it amounts to. And I just overheard his conversation with the cashier, and he was kind of proud of himself for what he'd gotten. And what he had was everything that bloomed right then. Everything in his cart, and he had two carts full of stuff.
And then it was going to be gone.
He had tulips. He had spring-blooming shrubs. He had perennials that bloomed early in the spring. He was talking about the great job he was going to do in somebody's yard. And by the end of April, it's all gone. Mm-hmm. And that drives me nuts. So point
you need
being,
a little more foresight.
Well, point being, if you're talking to a nurseryman, you want somebody to landscape your yard, and there's a lot of really good people doing that, think about having something in your yard every day
Don't
of the year.
Don't just fall for the stuff that's blooming right now.
Exactly.
It's
particularly spring blooming stuff. Because this lady would have had a great yard for 2 weeks, and nothing, literally nothing in bloom from April to October.
That's a problem for people, like why they can't,
so many
plants are overlooked
because
they don't look like anything right now, but they're going to be fabulous in September.
And also the big nursery suppliers will force the plants indoors, and even plants that normally bloom in midsummer, they'll be blooming in April and May.
Yeah.
Anyway, when if you're going to landscape your yard, think about landscaping your yard for the whole season and not just have a burst of color in April.
Very good point.
I vented and I'm glad I did.
Very good point.
How about the wish you
stayed? So can I now talk about how lovely my little spring garden is?
Please.
You know how much I love my little woodland garden around the house.
You should.
Because it's the time of the year where you're going outside and you're looking at stuff and you're waiting for stuff to come up and... It's nice because it's right around the house. You can go out there in the morning with your cup of coffee. And everything is so clean and clear in the spring of the year.
And green,
And green. And there's a different sort of clarity to the green and the textures. You know, even when the hostas first unfurl and the epimedium foliage, and, you know, the blooms are already up at the epimedium, but the foliage is still sort of dainty and it'll, you know, harden off the rest of the season. The bleeding hearts... The hellebores, all of these things are beautiful woodland spring, you know, kind of that intermediate shade garden thing if you're looking to plug in some plants. The ferns start to poke up and unfurl, and they're so dainty. I have this great little astrantia that the foliage is really sweet. Euphorbia is starting to poke through. The Solomon seal just sticking through and starting to unfurl. It's all so pretty, and it just makes you so anxious for the rest of it to unfold before you.
You're absolutely right, and I sort of call it the fool season because we forget in August there's going to be drought and weeds and stuff. So Get out there and plan for that, too. Yeah. Just plan beyond that.
It doesn't have to be that, but there may be drought, but yeah. It doesn't have to be that bad. But yeah, it's really, don't plant everything that blooms in the spring in your garden, but definitely get out there and enjoy those things that are coming up, because there's a clarity about it, I think, that's sort of restorative, to be sure, and optimistic.
Yep.
So that helps.
A lack of humidity will do that.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, goodness. And hopefully a lack of any sort of weird hard freeze, huh?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So speaking of summer and things to come, one of the things that people always look forward to are the garden tours. And for the last several years, they've done something called the Garden Tour Passport.
Right.
So at a reduced price, basically, you buy the passport and you get in the Crescent Hill Garden Tour, which is in June, early June, Audubon Park Garden Tour, which is in late June, and then the Old Louisville Garden Tour, which is in July. You get a $35 value for $27 if you buy in advance. Advance sales go through May 27th, Bob, and you can go online or you can go to Buttons, to Economy Aquatic Gardens, to the Plant Kingdom, to St. Matthew's Feed and Seed, to Thieneman's Herbs and Perennials, or to Wallach's to purchase your passport. So plan ahead, get a deal, and enjoy the gardens come summer.
And if you want to plan this afternoon...
There you go. And more immediate.
A couple of things. The long-going Audubon Dogwood Festival is today.
Yeah.
Goes on Audubon Park, of course. It's a great place to just drive around, look at the different plants and so forth, and of course the dogwoods. And then the Jefferson County Master Gardener Association is having a garden aganza at Whitehall Historic Home today from noon to 4 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
Ralph Archer, the fern guy, will be there to talk ferns.
Fern man.
Plants for sale, gently used garden tools, mm-hmm. books and magazines for sale, gardening tips, information, mm-hmm. everything.
Good place to start if you're new. People always ask us, I'm new at gardening, what do I do?
That's a great place.
That's what you do.
Whitehall or mm-hmm. Audubon Park.
Yep. Boxwood. I love boxwood.
I'm learning to. We created a special, there's a Janet's garden in the mm-hmm. middle of my whimsy and nonsense at Hidden Hill. And it's her garden. We're putting a boxwood, a formal hedge garden in there with boxwoods.
Mm-hmm.
And she's doing most of that. And so we've learned to appreciate boxwoods, different sizes, shapes.
Right. I mean, that's the thing. It's like there's so many different kinds.
Yeah, they can go from a foot to 15 feet.
Yeah.
So we need an expert to tell us the difference, and we've got one with us today. Our expert today is Kevin T. Collard, a graduate of Western Kentucky University. He opened Pine View Nursery in Litchfield, about 60 miles south of Louisville, about 14 years ago. He offers a full landscaping operation with about 600 cultivars of perennial shrubs and trees with special interest in boxwoods. Kevin, welcome to Homegrown.
Hi, Bob. Janine.
Thanks for coming in. He came into the studio all the way from Litchfield, where my people come from.
No people, yeah. I know.
Yeah. So, yeah, boxwood. I mean, you're a plantsman in the larger scheme of things, certainly, a nurseryman, but... why the interest in boxwood and why the interest in plants? It's like, Bob and I always want to know the story behind the story. How did you become a nursery owner?
I became a nursery owner. I guess planting was always in my family. You know, we had, like you, we had gardens when we were kids, mm-hmm. 1 acre garden, and, you know, we would get out and till and cultivate. And my grandmother was a big plant person, and I didn't know they were perennials. We just knew that they came back every year.
Right,
that's
exactly.
What they were called. And when I started in the university, I was in electrical engineering, but I started mowing lawns when I was 12 years old. And so, you know, one thing leads to another when you're mowing lawns. And I continued to mow lawns all the way through college. And calculus and physics was a deciding factor in changing a major. And I actually... one of my professors encouraged me to take a class in horticulture because mm-hmm. he kind of tested the waters for me and said, you know, you might do well there, and took it. And it was like a light bulb went off in my head and went from being a regular student to straight A mm-hmm. and
having fun and wanting to go to class.
Loved it. Loved it. Just couldn't get enough. So that's it in a nutshell. And then as soon as I got out of college, I started my own business mm-hmm. and...
Are you from Litchfield?
I am born and bred country boy, Litchfield.
All right.
Yes.
All right.
To that end, Kevin, it's interesting. I know that nursery business is about educating people, and I'm not demeaning Litchfield at all, but it's a town of 6,000 people in Grayson County. You have a lot of unusual plants. So education is obviously a strong part of the service you provide.
Yes. When I started the nursery, really still is no other nurseries besides mine. There's your big box stores, and then there's some lawn and garden seasonal type businesses. And so your basic landscaping at the time I started in business was yews and water maples.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I said that I will not sell, believe it or not, a yew at Pineview Nursery. And for the first 7 years, there was not a taxis on the property, believe it or not. But I really wanted to educate people that there is so much more out there, and there's plants that are slow growing and dwarf, and you can plant these plants and leave them alone. Mm-hmm. Let them do what God intended them to do, and do less maintenance and enjoy your garden rather than being a slave to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds like boxwood a little bit. How about the history of boxwood? How has it been around as a human plant?
You know, I should have really did my homework, and any of my boxwood friends are going to be ashamed. But, you know, boxwood actually is man's oldest garden ornamental. There's references to boxwood, Pliny, the Greek.
Pliny the Elder.
Right.
And the Younger, both probably.
Yeah.
Many references.
He wrote some, like, history of the
boxwood.
Natural history or something like that, but in some other language.
It's in there.
It's in there.
It's in the Bible. Uh-huh. You know, it's been used for centuries and thousands of years, I guess you would say. So, you know, it's been around. And really what got me kind of going on boxwood, you know, I love every kind of plant, you know, and most horticulturalists, especially the plant aficionados, consider boxwood to be a joke. It's just mm-hmm. such an ordinary plant, and what's the need of another boxwood? You know, mm-hmm. they're all the same. Well, that is really what got me going on boxwood. I was looking for different plants, and I was seeing some references to some really neat cultivars and some different plants, like, you know, you'll see Winter Jam, you'll see their common the common boxwood, Buxus sempervirens, you'll see Green Velvet, few other cultivars out there in the trade that are just grown like crazy. And then there's so many very, very nice cultivars that you never even hear anything about. People mm-hmm. are totally clueless on. So in 2000, I started my boxwood journey, and I'm still on it.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm a member of the Boxwood Society, and we can talk more about that, but there is a Boxwood Society. And, you know, it's just really interesting to find all these really cool plants that have every shape. What's interesting is there's every shape that you can think of that grows naturally that way.
Mm-hmm. How many, I know I've been to your demo garden, and I circled the tree with you and held your hand while we looked at boxwood and sang Cumbuya. How many different cultivars do you have there at Pineview?
You know, I've got a few more this year. I think I'm up around 40 cultivars.
Okay.
And a lot of those are still under evaluation. Some of them are very slow growers, so, you know, we're still testing them. And then that's part of what I'm trying to do, is find out what really grows good for us and what doesn't. And we'll talk about cultural conditions with boxwood and how they grow, but there's just some great plants. And so I have about 40. There's probably about 10 to 15 that I'm really pushing that are, you know, the cream that comes to the top.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk culture generally first, then we'll talk about some of your favorite cultivars.
Okay.
People seem to think it's nothing but full sun, but you changed my mind on that one.
Well, you know, I did too. I thought boxwood only grew in full sun, and lo and behold, they're actually what we call a high shade plant. They prefer the shade of really tall, mature trees. They'll do good in a pretty good amount of shade, actually. Better to have a little more shade than too much sun. What you find out with boxwood in the full sun is, if you put certain cultivars of boxwood in the full sun, in the winter, they will bronze.
That's right, right. Yeah.
And people think that's winter burn, they mm-hmm. call it. And it's not. It's just really the plant's almost sunburning. And that doesn't occur in the summer. That'll go away in the summer as it gets its new flush of growth. Mm-hmm. Even now, the bronze will start going away in the old leaves, and they'll start greening up. But if you put certain cultivars on a southern exposure and they get full sun all day, some will turn quite bronze, while others, on the other hand, will not at all. Mm-hmm. So that's something else we've
learned. Green Mountain, I've got one in a container that gets a whole lot of sun, and it bronzes out in the winter pretty nicely.
Yeah, some
or not, depending on what your proclivity is. Okay, it's clear that you can put them in sun, full sun, you know, but expect some different results, some shade. But what about soil? Are they considered pretty tough plants, or do we need to provide them with a little bit more of a cush sort of soil environment?
They really are tough. if you put the right cultivar in the right spot. Okay. The main thing is that, that boxwood don't like heavy clay soil, as do...
Nobody does.
Yeah, nobody does. So, so, you know, unfortunately, a lot of us have that problem. But they like more of an alkaline soil, so they don't really like acidic pH, although you'll find them growing in those spots. Mm-hmm. So a well-drained soil with more on the alkaline side, you know, 6.5 to 7, you know, even neutral would be okay. So, you know, you might need to lime your plants. I know here in Louisville, you all have more... alkaline soil than we do at home. We generally have 5.5 to 6, something like that. Okay. Sometimes we'll get some 6.5, but they will grow in acidic soil, but it's better to have them a little alkaline.
Okay.
Well-drained soil, I think, is the most important. And then knowing there's a handful of cultivars that just won't take full sun. They just are going to be sad. You're going to see it after a year or two, and it's just not worth it. So there, and there's just a few of those that just don't take the sun at all. Most of them will grow in the full sun.
Which,
you'll just have to.
Which ones are not best suited for full sun situation?
The ones that you're going to see, a lot of them you probably won't even hear of. One of them is called Tide Hill. It won't take sun. One of the most common boxwood, you don't see them everywhere, but it's one of the most, the oldest used, is Saffruticosa.
Uh-huh.
Saffruticosa, which is what they call the true English boxwood or English edging boxwood. Mm-hmm. It will take full sun. But I find it is so much better with
some shade.
If it's got some high shade or if it's not in a southern exposure. Now, I'll tell you this. I've got them planted in southern exposures, and they're doing all right.
Mm-hmm. But they do magnificently if they're not in such a difficult situation.
And you need, if you've got them in full sun, then you better have your drainage right.
Okay.
Now, maybe name 4 or 5 other cultivars you think might be applicable in Kentucky, Southern Indiana area that
are not the usual suspects.
Yeah. That are not the usual for...
That they'll have to come to Litchfield and get them from you.
Well, you know, I can tell you, are we going to start on my favorites? Is that what we're doing?
Yeah.
One of the cream that's rose to the top is one called Justin Brower's, and that's also the Buxus Seneca variety Insularis. And mm-hmm. Justin Brower's is a great plant. It has a very dark foliage. It will not bronze in the full sun, so it does fine in sun or shade. A 15-year growth projection on Justin Brower's is 2 to 3 feet tall and 3 to 4 feet wide after 15 years with no pruning.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's perfect for what most everyone needs is what we call foundation.
And it's
foundation.
True because, I mean, one of the questions that I get often is, oh, these shrubs in front of the house haven't been touched or maintained for years. You know, what do I do? They're all overgrown. And if you have something that's, you know, the right cultivar for the spot, then you don't run into those problems that so many homeowners face because they don't prune annually.
What are some other ones you like? Some other favorites?
Okay. Next in line, you know, a really good one that you can find pretty common, or I should say more common now, is one called Green Gem.
Right.
And that's one of the Sheridan cultivars from Ontario, Canada. It's very hardy. It grows to about a 2 by 3 foot ball. So if you want a perfect, now let me back up. Justin Brower's is kind of a mounded plant, like a pincushion. Right. Green Gem pretty much grows like almost like a perfect ball. Hmm. And it's very dense, it's very slow growing, and it just really keeps such a really tight growth habit that all you have to do is just prune the top little, usually that secondary flush. You'll get a couple of little branches that are sticking up above the base of the plant. But I have found that Green Gem will bronze in the winter if it's in too much sun. Now, it doesn't hurt it. Does just fine, but you put it in a partly shaded area, and it's just a deep, dark green plant.
What's another one then?
Okay, those are small. One of my favorite of the very smallest cultivars is Buxus microphylla, and the cultivar is Grace Hendrick Phillips. They grow like a pincushion, and 15-year growth on Grace Hendrick Phillips is about 1 to 1.5 feet tall by 2 to 2.5 feet wide. After 15 years.
Wow.
How about a big one? What's a good one to get 5-6 feet tall?
5 to 6 feet tall?
Yeah.
You know, green velvet is a good plant. It gets 4 by 4, something like that.
Yeah.
Another variety that I think is going to become more common, it's not quite common yet, is one called True Spreader, or sometimes you will see it listed as Jim's True Spreader, and now the correct cultivar name is Jim Stouffer. And that's also a Buxus microphylla. Jim Stouffer, or true spread or whatever you want to call it, gets about 4x4, a little bit bigger. It has such a deep, dark green foliage. Now, it has a leaf kind of closer to the size of like winter gem. You know, it's kind of a bigger rounded leaf, but it is very deep, dark, almost a black green.
Wow. So are there other favorites in terms of cultivars that have different types of shapes? Because one of my favorite is a more pyramidal sort of shape. So
let me tell you two of my favorite. Or actually, I'll give you three really good pyramidals, and the main difference is going to be ultimate size on these. Okay. You mentioned Green Mountain. Mm-hmm. That's a great pyramidal shape, and Green Mountain grows about 2 to 3 feet wide and 4 to 6 feet tall if you let it. And, you know, it is a beautiful plant left alone. It really is.
Yeah, it's I never prune it. So
right. It's just awesome. Great left on its own. And it will grow a tight pyramid. Mm-hmm. It'll kind of round on the top just a little bit. So that's a good small pyramidal. I say pyramidal. I don't know. I'm going to say pyramidal.
Tomato.
One of the next, this is an exceptional plant here. This is Buxus sempervirens D. Runk. And I think Bob has some in his garden.
I do.
D. Runk grows at the base about 2.5 feet wide and about 10, 12 feet tall. And it's going to take it 15 years to get there. And sounds let me cool. tell you, it is a very narrowly tall exclamation point in the landscape.
Wow.
And so it does have, it's like a pinnacle. It's a very tall, slim plant, and it has about a 45-degree branch angle. So those branches are really strong. They'll take a good snow load. So that's an exceptional plant. One that's a little bit bigger than that, basically the same growth habit, is called Fastigiata. That's also Buxus sempervirens. And Fastigiata is about the same, except instead of being about 2.5 feet wide at the base, it'll get about 4 feet wide at the base and go up to 10 or more feet tall. So it's the same thing, except wider.
Mm-hmm.
And those are two really good, or actually three really good pyramidal growth habits.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's some other really nice plants. Elegantissima is a variegated cultivar. A lot of people aren't even aware that that's out there. But there's numerous cultivars of variegated boxwood, and I have several myself. You just need to come and look at them to see them and appreciate them because, you know, the descriptions just don't do it because there's green with a creamy variegation. There's some green with a yellow, almost a splotched or marbled variegation. There's some that have a very fine white variegation around the edge, and those have various growth habits as well. So
sounds like there's lots to choose from.
I know. What about the dreaded pruning? I mean, you're almost averse to pruning, I know, but some people just have those neat trim boxwoods no matter what. Is that a good idea, a bad idea?
Well, the way you should properly prune a boxwood is what we call thinning or plucking. And basically what you're doing is you're actually reaching into the body of the plant, and you're cutting some big branches out. And what you're doing is you're kind of leaving a small hole. And what that's going to do is that's going to fill back in. And the best time to do plucking or thinning is really August after they've kind of hardened off. You can do it in the summer. You can do it anytime, but that's the best because the growth is hardened off. And then you kind of leave those holes. And it's not really a hole like, you know, it's not like a big hole in the plant, but you can see where there's a little air space.
Yeah.
What's important with boxwoods is air circulation. And what inhibits air circulation is when we shear and shear and shear year after year, and we get that dome or what I would call a shell of foliage, air can't penetrate it. So then you set yourself up for diseases like Volutella and Microphoma leaf spot and things like that that people attribute to other problems when really it's the pruning practice. So, you know, it's boxwood have been sheared for as long as they've been around, because, you know, that's what people think of, unfortunately. And I'm on a crusade to, well, let's release the boxwood, let them go.
You know? Exactly.
So, you know, by the cultivars.
That's
the
do
key.
What you want them
what you
to
want.
Do. Yeah. Any significant insect pest problems that confront boxwood? I know leaf miners and, you know, leaf inside the foliage, basically, is typically
minor.
What we're going to see. How do people deal with that and focus on preventing those issues?
You know, to be honest, I have to say, I have never had a leaf miner problem myself. I see that commonly in books and things like that. The most common problems that I have are spider mites.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen Green Mountain get some spider mites before. Some cultivars don't seem to be affected at all. Others, you know, some, and others a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And then right now, actually, it's a little bit earlier than what we normally see it, but the boxwood psyllid, spelled psyllid, P-S-Y-L-L-I-D.
Right.
The boxwood psyllid is probably one of the more common problems. And what you find with that boxwood psyllid is it gets in the buds of the leaves and causes a cupping problem. As the new foliage emerges, that leaf is all
distorted.
Cupped.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it really doesn't hurt the plant, but it sure does make it look bad. So you can trim that cupped foliage off.
And if you clip it off at the right stage, then you'll get rid of the eggs that have been laid that caused the distortion too. All right.
Well, Kevin, thank you. Obviously, you got a passion for boxwood that goes beyond the normal, and we appreciate that in any plants people.
Indeed.
Thanks a lot.
Kevin T. Collard is the owner of Pine View Nursery in Litchfield, Kentucky. For more information on Kevin, his nursery, or boxwoods, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, the worm. There's more to the earthworm than meets the eye. Clive Edwards from Ohio State University joins us after the break. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
We know a great deal about boxwoods. Now we need to know some of the better
things
about the earth in which to contain them.
In which to contain them and the worms that help them thrive. Yeah. Bob and I think, we've been on the earthworm bandwagon for a while now.
Give me a W. Give me an O. Give me an R. Give me an M.
It is. I have to say that when I dig in the dirt, the thing that excites me the most if I see a whole lot of earthworms, because I know that it's going to be a better growing environment for whatever I'm sticking in there.
Did you ever take the childhood dare and bite one in half?
No. Can't say that I did.
You're in the company of a guy that did.
I'm sure
you did.
To
tell about it.
I'm sure you're. Well, we'll find out from Dr. Edwards.
How lucky I was.
if that worm actually regenerated into two different worms after you bit it in half.
Right.
Joining us now is Dr. Clive Edwards. He is the department chair of entomology at Ohio State University and the program director for soil ecology there. His area of research includes environmental and soil ecosystems, the persistence of pesticides and organic matter in the soil, earthworms, and vermiculture, among other things. He has published extensively on soil ecology and is quite the name when it comes to earthworms. Clive Edwards, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Great. Let me ask you first, academic work in soil ecology, it's changed over the years, hasn't it? It seems like, you know, once agricultural practices became more industrialized, we thought about the soil, like, quite frankly, very little. And now you see more information coming out of institutions encouraging people to be a little more gentle on their soil. So has it changed?
Yeah, it's changed dramatically, of course, because it all changed after the Second World War when they discovered DDT and other pesticides and the hormone weed killers and things. Thereafter, immediately within a few years after the war, instead of being keep controlling pest diseases and providing nutrients in sort of more organic ways, it all became chemical. Some of these have had some broader bad effects. For instance, in weed control, once they found very effective herbicides, which they thought were safe, and it's not been confirmed that they are safe, but they thought they were. Literally, all the education in weed control, other than chemicals, stopped.
They sort of decided that it was
what
it was.
Huh? Well, it's still with us even now, because at Ohio State here, we've probably got about 20 plant pathologists and about 25 or 30 entomologists, we have two weed control specialists.
Hmm. So that's interesting.
They still rely on the chemicals.
Right. And we'll get to some of the residual issues in terms of pesticides in a little bit, too. But let's go ahead and hit the worms. How long have earthworms been around? Do we have fossil proof that they've been around forever?
Because they're soft-bodied, you don't get any fossils.
Oh, okay.
But from genetic points of view, they've obviously been around forever.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the whole of the distribution in the United States changed with the Ice Age, because they were all over the United States before the Ice Age, but then the ice eradicated those from the northern part.
Hmm.
Oh. So when the ice went away, they had to recolonize again, and oddly enough, the native species didn't come back very much, and it was then colonized by the settlers who brought earthworms from Europe.
Huh. So how many different kinds of earthworms are there?
They're quoted as 3,000 species, but I'm not sure that that's true, you know, because it's considering it's an important group, there are not too many taxonomists. I probably know more than about 10 or a dozen in the world, really good ones, and they don't all agree with one another either. There's a lot of difference of opinion.
So the average earthworm that I'm going to uncover in my garden, what kind of worm is that? Is that considered the night crawler?
Well, it is.
Or could I run into a couple of different types in my garden?
Oh, yeah. In any garden or in an agricultural field, you probably get about 6 or 7 species.
Okay.
The night crawler is probably the most important of them all in turn, because it really takes organic matter down into the soil. So it plays a pretty important role in getting rid of organic matter. I mean, that's what's so crazy about everybody putting their leaf material in bags and throwing them in landfills, because in fact it's that organic matter that actually breeds the earthworm population up.
Mm-hmm. Well, can we talk about like a year in the life of an earthworm, the mating habits, the babies, the whole sexual process of these things?
Yes,
yeah, I mean, pretty much it depends where you are, but if in northern United States or even down a little bit in the south, it's pretty much a seasonal thing. I mean, earthworms don't like getting too hot, and they don't like getting too cold. So they manage to survive through the adverse seasons in various ways. They mostly produce their cocoons in spring, and so a lot of them overwinter the dry periods as cocoons and then hatch again in the autumn. But particularly nightcrawler and some species like that, they can go down 2 or 3 feet in the soil and stay quite safe.
Mm-hmm. So are there eggs down there in the soil then?
They usually do their mating on the surface.
Okay.
They lay the cocoons near the surface.
So what would what time of the year could I potentially uncover some of the cocoons, and what would they look like?
Well, if you've been pretty much in late spring or early autumn.
Okay.
Be the best times.
And what do they look like, Clive?
Well, what's sort of funny is that there's so many different species of earthworms, but every cocoon can be recognized by its shape. Each one is different. I mean, the way they're formed is that the worms lie close together in opposite directions, and they mate one another. They fertilize one another.
Mm-hmm.
And then each one will wriggle through the band that's over its body. They call it the clitellum. And they wriggle through that, and it comes over the head.
Uh-huh.
And then it sets hard, and that becomes a cocoon.
Oh.
So but each cocoon can have, some species only have one egg in a cocoon, but some species have as many as 20.
Huh.
So it's quite variable between the various species.
So I see these writhing mass of worms sometimes. Is that just a mass mating ritual, more or less?
No. I mean,
is it one-on-one? I'm trying to get...
No, they come out. It's when they come out, when it's wet.
Okay.
Okay.
I mean, that's really the problem. They don't like having the burrows flooded.
Okay.
So if you see masses of earthworms, that's what it's about.
Mm-hmm.
The main problems... Europe and the United States, was on very wet days, they come out like that under runways on airports, and you get skidding planes. And
oh, my gosh.
The other thing is they attract birds, so you get bird strikes as well.
Right.
So it goes both those ways.
Yeah. Clive, let's talk about soil ecology on sort of a bigger scale,
sure.
If we can. How crucial are earthworms to soil health? And I guess, you know, before we get into that, let's define healthy soil. I think a lot of people are confronted with woefully unhealthy soil, therefore their plants don't do well,
yeah.
Et cetera. So what's healthy soil to begin with?
I mean, the critical issue is having a high organic matter content. It's more important than anything else. If you've got a good organic matter content, it breeds microorganisms like crazy. It favors the earthworms. It favors a lot of other invertebrates. But I think that's the critical issue, organic matter. People talk about cultivations, but you do better if you go to no-till.
Mm-hmm.
You get better, more natural soil. But then you run into the problem with no-till that the organic matter doesn't get taken down unless you have Lumbricus terrestris and night crawler.
Mm-hmm.
What do they eat?
Your organic matter.
Organic matter.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a misnomer in a way, because that's what they consume.
Right.
But they don't get their nourishment from the organic matter, because they don't have the right enzymes. So they get their nourishment from the microbes that live on the organic matter.
Yeah, so let's talk about that, because what else is in the soil that works with the earthworms?
Well, they'll eat anything. I mean,
keep the soil healthy, though. But the whole mycorrhizal fungi and
yeah, they move mycorrhizae around.
Yeah.
So that's been shown quite clearly.
Mm-hmm.
We did some experiments years ago, and we found their favorite food were fungi, actually, growing on the organic matter rather than some of the microbes. But also we've done some more recent stuff and show they'll eat nematodes like crazy.
Mm-hmm. Essentially, Clive, then, do most people have unhealthy garden soils if we're thinking about a conventional sort of vegetable garden because people over-cultivate, overuse mechanical equipment? Are they breaking down not only the earthworms but also the fungi and the bacteria and the nematodes?
No, not really. The cultivation is not so dreadfully harmful in a sense. I mean, the harm is you turn the thing upside down. If you plow, you take the subsoil and you put it up on the top.
Uh-huh.
And that's the, all the good things are in the topsoil. So when you invert it, you're losing some of the better qualities.
How long does it take for it to kind of right itself?
Well, I mean, when this is what happens when they go to no-till. I mean, half the soils in the United States are in no-till at the moment, but it's been increasing a lot this last year or two since they've been moving over to doing bioethanol from corn.
Mm-hmm.
Ethanol, I mean. So that's meant they've been increasing some of the acreages, and they've been doing it into no-till.
Well, let's go back to the pesticide question and say if you use Roundup extensively on your ground, which is supposed to be inert in the soil, but does that affect the earthworms, these pesticides and herbicides?
We did a review about 10, 12 years ago of everything that had ever been published on it, and we found there were about 200 pesticides in common use at that time. But only about 20 of them were really toxic to earthworms. Not all of them were. But some groups, like the carbamate insecticides, are very toxic to earthworms, almost all of them.
Mm-hmm. Like what's in 7?
And that's it. Yeah. 7 is a carbamate.
Mm-hmm.
That's
mm-hmm.
the one they use to kill the earthworms on golf greens.
What about the pesticide or herbicides like Roundup?
And most of them don't do any direct damage. Just one or two have some slight effects, but they're not really very toxic.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Fertilizers, conventional fertilizers?
Well, fertilizers, it's funny enough, unless they're a certain sort, tend to favor the earthworms in a way because they increase the organic matter, increase productivity, so they do better. But the some of the ones that have ammonia in them, ammonium nitrate, earthworms do not like ammonia. So ammonium nitrate or ammonium sulfate will soon knock down earthworm populations if used regularly.
Okay. What about the residual effects of organic matter? I mean, how long does that remain viable in the soil?
Oh, but it has a long-term effect. Mm-hmm. It's really, you can get residual effects for several years, if not more. You know, it doesn't disappear very rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're saying then, maybe you're better off leaving your leaves and compost and such in the garden rather than raking it up, and like we say every fall, and clean your garden?
Absolutely. There's a well-known ecologist over at Cornell, David Pimentel. You may have heard of him.
Yeah.
And he goes up and down the road where he lives. I've been to visit him a number of times. And he just, he collects everybody else's leaves and put it on his garden.
I'm going to have my wife call you after the show.
I know, exactly.
She drives me nuts with that.
Uh-huh. It would solve a whole great many problems, I think, if we just held on to our leaves every year, huh? So Clive, how is agriculture responding, and how are home gardeners responding to, you know, more information like the research that you guys are doing at Ohio State University in terms of no-till, you know, using more organic matter that you already have at home in your garden, appreciating your earthworms? Are people responding in active ways to this new information?
I think to some extent they always have. I don't know why, but my feeling is, and this is from Europe where I was originally and here, is that farmers really appreciate earthworms.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, give you an example. About 5 or 6 years ago, I was asked to give a lecture down in North Carolina, have a day when it was just me and one other person lecturing on earthworms all day. And for that meeting, we had 600 farmers that turned up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they obviously appreciate earthworms.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So there's somewhat of a cost effectiveness to it as well as new technologies are developed like no-till,
right.
Using organic matter instead of chemical, conventional fertilizers and, you know, pesticides,
right.
because those things are expensive. So that's a good selling point as well, I would imagine.
Well, you see, most of our current research, and has been for the last 10 years, has been on vermicomposting, which is breaking down organic matter with earthworms, a technical system. And it's quite amazing. Well, if you breed earthworms in organic matter, we call it vermiculture, and there are high-tech systems of doing it. The material you produce, which we call a vermicompost, is enormously effective for growing plants. And, you can add about, 10% to the potting soils, and they go crazy.
Mm-hmm.
The reason for that is because there's a strong link between earthworms and microbial activity. I told you they live on microbes. And if you've got a lot of earthworms, you'll get a lot of microorganisms. And there's been pretty well known over the last 10, 15, 20 years that microorganisms can produce plant growth hormones.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And we've done some fairly critical studies here to show that that's what's happening. And we've actually extracted them from the vermicompost in a dry form and put them back into growth media and replicated the effects. So we think we know what it is. But what's interesting is that this last year, there's been a lot of talk about, I don't know if you've seen it, but compost and vermicompost teas,
mm-hmm.
liquids which people are asked to pour on and do, create magic. Well, it's very popular, but there's very little scientific backup research for it.
Mm-hmm.
So we started doing this, and we found last year that we took these extracts. First of all, we found out how to do it and how to get the best material. But then once we did it, we found we're getting very, very good increases in growth. But what's over and above that, we were getting very good pest and disease control, insects, diseases, and nematodes, particularly nematodes. It's unbelievable what effect it had on nematodes.
Huh. So a truly remarkable ecosystem in the soil if you don't mess with it too much and let it naturally occur, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, amazing.
Excellent.
Clive, thank you so much. We really appreciate your time.
Yes, sir.
Okay, sure.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Clive Edwards is the Department Chair of Entomology at Ohio State University and the Program Director of Soil Ecology, where soil ecosystems, earthworms, and other things in the soil are center stage. If you'd like more information on Clive Edwards and his research and Ohio State's Soil Ecology Program, please visit our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, a few listeners' questions and Miss Wishy's new Latin Word of the Week. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
With a plethora of questions here.
We do have a plethora of questions. It's that time of the year, I suppose.
Yeah.
How about it? This is a good one for this time of the year because people are cleaning up their gardens. Actually, it's two different questions sort of addressing the same thing, Bob. One is from Renee Bauer and the other one's from Harold Hope. One, basically having somebody come in, they're weeding and remulching the garden. She had used the cypress mulch
mm-hmm.
in the past. Wondering our recommendations in terms of what type of mulch to use, because cost effectiveness, the people recommended using hardwood mulch because it's cheaper. But are there, you know, advantages or disadvantages? Same. The other question from Harold, essentially the same thing, but also adds to the question about not recommending the use of black plastic under
yeah,
mulch.
Yeah, I don't use black plastic at all. I don't like the. Eventually, the stuff washes off, and you're looking at black plastic, among other things.
And it's not really good for perennial or woody plant material.
No, because nothing can rot down into it.
Yeah.
And I prefer hardwood mulch to cypress just for looks, if nothing else. And it looks more natural to me.
Really? See, and I prefer cypress over hardwood. And anything chunkier. I remember Bill Fountain talking about how the chunkier, like the pine nuggets,
right.
pine bark nuggets, yeah. even pine straw, the chunkier the mulch, the better, because that hardwood mulch sometimes crusts over, becomes hydrophobic, people use too much. So the chunkier, the better, because better water penetration and better oxygen penetration.
See, I use a couple inches of hardwood because mm-hmm. I don't pile it up where it gets real mm-hmm. thick and wet,
yeah.
and I just think it looks better. But
yeah.
it works for me. As long as you don't, you're right, don't overdo it.
Yeah.
Don't pile your mulch a foot thick around anything,
because
mm-hmm. that will suffocate the plants.
Yeah. But a recommendation for plant health is the chunkier the better.
Okay, so. We'll just have to agree to
have
different methods than this one.
But that's the thing. People love their hardwood mulch because of yeah. the aesthetics
and
of it.
I've not gotten that because I'm very careful how I use
mm-hmm.
it.
Yeah, and most people aren't, Bob, you know. So, right. So yeah, either way, just don't overdo it, as he says, 2 inches max on any type of mulch product.
All right, Ms. Wishy, here's a question from a Penny Johnson. I love it because she refers to her tree as her.
I do too sometimes, yeah.
That's really kind of cool.
Or him, depending on what the plant is.
If it's alive or dead. Anyway, she planted 3 willow oaks, about 25 feet tall now, 6 inches in diameter. One of the oaks has a problem. She's not sure what to do about it. The leaves are light green to yellow. There's half as much foliage as the other two trees. She fertilizes each spring with tree spikes, but they seem to have no effect. My first thought is lack of nitrogen. However, the rest of the garden is always lush and green. Found no disease or scale. Any suggestions on improving her health?
Her health. She might just be a bad child.
Yeah, right.
Since you have 3 shingle, or willow oaks rather, I'm sorry, planted at the same time, in the same vicinity, you can't always blame like the site or fertility on the plant,
right,
or on the poor performance of a plant. At the nursery before she brought it home, it could have skipped a couple of waterings and been put at a disadvantage for some reason. The roots could be girdled on that one particular mm-hmm. tree because it wasn't planted properly, or maybe it was planted too deep. There are other factors that will determine whether or not an individual is going to be healthy or not,
exactly.
Just like humans.
Exactly.
Actually, the trees, the fertilizer spikes, I wouldn't use those at all, especially in the first couple of years of plants getting established. Water's going to be your key element. It's that whole sleep, creep, and leap concept. First year, you establish your root system. Second year, you push out a little top growth. Third year, then you're all, you know, in good shape. Unfortunately, this freeze might cause some problems for trees that are the bad child. The healthy tree should be fine. The bad child may have a little bit of a problem. So again, the key component here for health is going to be water. Some of these, and you know, actually, I'm not sure if willow oaks would have already leafed out by now. I guess it depends on where you are. I know many of my oaks have not leafed out yet, but if they got nipped from the freeze, they'll have to push out new growth, which is going to be harder for them. So if they're at a disadvantage already, it's going to zap their energy. So if we go into periods of drought this summer, just make sure that you keep water on your plants.
And if it doesn't recover by fall, I'd consider a chainsaw.
Replacing, exactly.
Or something
and,
worse.
You know, the willow oaks, I don't think they're highly... They don't demand acidic soil, although they like the pH a little bit lower.
Right.
But they like water because they're typically found, native speaking, on bottomlands. So they're going to really appreciate extra water staying like moist and well-drained.
It's a neat tree. I love the leaf.
Yeah.
Hence the willow oak part.
Exactly.
If you have a question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org or call us at 814-8246. Well, Miss Wishy, we're into the Joe Stalin mode here on the show, I see.
Sort of is.
I'm a little worried about this one, Ken. You could be Homeland Security maybe circling here.
But it makes a lot of sense, really, the root of this Latin word of the week. It's communists.
As in Communist Party, or?
Communists as in common, general, or growing in company.
Oh, there's no T on it. It's communists.
Communists.
Okay.
Communists.
I'm safe.
So, yeah, the common, certainly, but I think it means more than just the common...
Right.
Variety of something like vulgaris does because of growing in company. So, for example, carex, communists.
The fibrous root carex.
Mm-hmm. Ferula, communists.
The giant fennel. That
giant
sounds
fennel.
Like a movie.
It does.
The attack of the ferula. Giant fennel.
I like ferula.
Yeah.
Juniperus, communists.
Oh, yeah, the old creeping juniper.
The common or creeping juniper,
absolutely.
Yeah. Lapsana, communists.
The common nipple wart.
Can't deny a plant like that.
No, you can't hardly say it in the radio.
Myrtus, communists.
The old myrtle.
Myrtle. Pyrus, communists.
The wild pear.
The wild pear, the common pear you see it out along the roadsides this time of the year blooming, kind of a scrappy looking tree.
Yeah.
Ricinus communis.
The good old castor bean.
Did you know that the castor bean was common, general, or growing in company?
Or a member of the Communist Party? I had no idea.
Actually, the castor bean.
That one
bean
might
could
be, actually. Yeah. That'd be the candidate for
that. That would be indeed. So, right. Yeah, if you see communis associated with the Latin word of a plant, you can be assured that it's growing in good company, but perhaps that would be common company.
And you're safe, comrade, from us. Yes.
All right. All right. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. We certainly hope that you'll join us next week for another show.
Homegrown is produced by the rarely stumped Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.